Friday, July 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, three former presidents join mourners at the Atlanta funeral to honor the life and legacy of civil rights icon John Lewis.
A believer willing to give up everything, even life itself, to bear witness to the truth that drove him all his life. That we could build a world of peace and justice, harmony and dignity and love.
How COVID-19 is impacting the mental health of children. Also ahead, NASA's new Mars rover launches from Florida to seek signs of past life. It's all on today's International Edition. Congressman John Lewis was mourned, revered, and celebrated as an American hero Thursday at Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church, a sacred place for many of those who helped to shape civil rights history. Three former presidents joined in the eulogies after nearly a week of mourning that took Lewis from his birthplace in Alabama to the nation's capital of Washington to his final resting place in his home of Atlanta. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
What a gift John Lewis was.
Barack Obama was one of three former presidents remembering Lewis inside Atlanta's historic Ebenezer Baptist Church.
He's been called an American saint.
Joining George W. Bush and Bill Clinton in recalling Lewis's lifelong push for a better America.
We salute, suit up, and march on.
Obama called Lewis a man of pure joy and unbreakable perseverance, striving until the end to build a more perfect union. He says when it eventually happens.
Even if it takes another two centuries, John Lewis will be a founding father.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The funeral came just hours after President Trump, for the first time, raised the idea of delaying the November election. As former President Barack Obama delivered the eulogy at Lewis's funeral, he warned the very things Lewis spent his life championing, American voting rights, are under attack.
There are those in power who are doing their darndest to discourage people from voting by closing polling locations and targeting minorities and students with restrictive ID laws and attacking our voting rights with surgical precision, even undermining the Postal Service in the run-up to an election that's going to be dependent on mail-in ballots so people don't get sick.
Last month in Arizona, President Trump suggested increased mail-in voting due to the coronavirus pandemic will lead to voter fraud.
This will be, in my opinion, the most corrupt election in the history of our country.
The pandemic is expected to lead to a surge in mail-in and absentee ballot voting. Joining us to talk about the constitutional legalities of the president's suggestion of postponing the upcoming election is Edward Foley, constitutional law professor and director of election law at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Thank you so much for being with us. So can President Trump actually change the election date?
No. The Constitution specifies that the current presidential term ends at noon on January 20th. So if there's no presidential election, his term still ends, and the 20th Amendment to the Constitution calls for an acting president at that point. Also, there needs to be congressional elections, not just the presidential election, because the current term of the House of Representatives and the senators who are up this year, their terms also end on January 3rd. So there is going to be an election, and Congress gets to set the date. Congress has set the date as November 3rd. It seems impossible. I mean, Congress theoretically could change the date, but I don't think there's any chance that they will. And so we're going to go forward with an election. There is going to be the effect of COVID, and it's going to be challenging because of COVID. But the plan is still to make sure that every eligible voter has an adequate opportunity to cast a ballot, whether that's by mail or in person. And if that happens, then we're going to count the votes and produce a winner.
Is there any evidence to substantiate any of the claims that mail-in voting could be supposedly rigged or fraudulent?
I think evidence is the key word there. American election law has procedures to make sure that the tally is accurate, reflecting the will of the voters. And one way that happens is to verify the eligibility of all ballots cast. Now, those in person, the voters are verified by checking in with the poll workers and signing the poll workbook and making sure they're registered voters and the signature matches. Something similar happens for the vote by mail. when that envelope gets returned to local officials, that ballot will not be counted unless there's a verification that it comes from a registered voter and the signature matches again. Some of the news stories recently have talked about the rejection rates of absentee ballots or vote by mail, and that's a reason to kind of look at that, because those rates can be too high if there's a fear that the clerks are rejecting too many mail ballots. But the flip side of this point is that the rejection rates are showing you that a mailed ballot doesn't automatically get counted just because it arrives. It has to be verified. And that means there's no reason to think that intrinsically mail ballots are inherently fraudulent. There's just no evidence for that. It's a type of voting that exists. In many states, it's the voter's choice whether to vote in person or by mail. And so the legal process requires that those ballots be counted unless there's evidence to show that there's something wrong with the ballot.
The president has also not guaranteed that he would just accept the results if he does not win the election. If that were the case, and Joe Biden won by a pretty large margin, and the president still wouldn't accept the results, where do we go from there?
Well, ultimately, it matters what Congress does, because under the Constitution, this is the 12th Amendment, there's a joint session of Congress. Both the Senate and the House of Representatives meet together to review the Electoral College submissions from the states. It's scheduled for January 6th, just 2 days before the inauguration of the new president, or Donald Trump if he's reelected. So it's really up to Congress in that sense. If both parties in Congress, senators and representatives, if they all agree to the outcome, that's what will happen. So if both the Senate and the House say that Vice President Biden has won, that will be the official declaration. And what President Trump says won't matter. He may have some supporters who are disappointed like he is, but in terms of the law, it'll be what Congress says. Today is an important signal that his own party in Congress won't automatically follow what his wishes are. After his tweet about this idea of delaying the election, that was, as I see it, uniformly rejected on both sides of the aisle in Congress. Leader McConnell and other senators on the Republican side and Republicans in the House uniformly rejected the idea of delaying the election. That's a signal to me that after November 3rd, if the numbers show that President Trump is lost, his own party in Congress may accept those numbers. And another thing to think about in this point is that Senator Lamar Alexander in particular, but other senators as well, explained their acquittal vote on the impeachment charges on the ground that he should not be removed from office because the election would be decisive. In other words, the American people were going to be able to make a judgment in the election on whether or not President Trump deserved a second term. The implication of that argument at the time of impeachment is to respect the judgment of the American people.
Edward Foley, constitutional law professor and the director of election law at the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. The coronavirus outbreak in the United States appears to be shifting to the Midwest as the surge in the South shows signs of abating. That's according to White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Deborah Birx. But in an interview on Fox News, she said an uptick in coronavirus cases is appearing in at least a half a dozen other states, likely driven by Americans traveling in the summer season. The U.S. economy also suffered its biggest blow since the Great Depression in the second quarter, as the COVID-19 pandemic shattered consumer and business spending. Economists say with coronavirus cases surging in many states, the economy could worsen even more in the months ahead. The World Health Organization's chief scientist, Sunya Swaminathan, said in a news briefing from Geneva Thursday that the more countries that join COVAX, a scheme designed to guarantee fast and equitable access globally to COVID-19 vaccines, the greater its chances of success.
So any country that supports COVAX has a better chance of getting a successful vaccine candidate than going after a single one on their own. This, of course, requires that the COVAX pillar, the vaccine pillar of the accelerator, be fully funded to the tune of about $32 billion, and also that many countries join this facility because The more the countries that join this facility and contribute to this risk pooling mechanism, the greater the chances of success and also the greater the speed at which we could move.
More than 75 countries have expressed an interest in joining COVAX, which is co-led by the Gavi Vaccines Alliance, the World Health Organization, and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Its aim is to deliver 2 billion doses of effective approved COVID-19 vaccines by the end of 2021. Some global health agencies are concerned about whether countries going it alone in the race for a coronavirus vaccine, striking deals with drug makers to secure millions of doses of promising candidates for just their own citizens. Meanwhile, cases of COVID-19 more than doubled in July across African countries. The International Rescue Committee warned that a lack of testing in crisis-affected areas is keeping responders in the dark about the real spread of the disease. Australia's COVID-19 crisis is intensifying with a record 723 new infections reported in the state of Victoria in the past day. 13 people have died. Some internal borders in eastern Australia will again close in a bid to stop the spread of the virus. Australia has had about 15,500 confirmed coronavirus cases. Phil Mercer has more from Sydney.
And masks are mandatory when they do so. Residents from Sydney, which has several COVID-19 clusters, will soon be banned from travelling to Queensland. Queensland State Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk.
We declared yesterday Greater Sydney a hotspot that will take effect from 1 a.m. Saturday. That is definitely the right decision that we have made to protect Queensland and Queenslanders' health.
Australia's international borders were closed to foreign travellers in March and are likely to stay shut into next year. Australian citizens returning home face a mandatory 14 days in hotel quarantine. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Nearly a half year into the COVID-19 pandemic, its impact on the mental health of children remains an open question. To find out more about the fears many children of frontline workers are facing and what can be done to protect their mental health, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke by Zoom with Janine Dominiques, a clinical psychologist in the Anxiety Disorders Center at the Child Mind Institute in New York. She began by emphasizing the unusual stresses many are experiencing during the pandemic.
They're having to think about it and be faced with it much more often than children of non-frontline workers. And so anxiety about being sick, anxiety about their parents being at risk, and anxiety for themselves too. And unfortunately, given how we protect one another from the virus, children aren't with parents who might be at the front line, or they might have to distance and isolate from them. That can also increase anxiety as well. So they're just at a greater risk for mental health difficulties since they're faced with the real fear of their parents potentially dying.
So there's sort of a double whammy for kids of frontline workers. They've got the everyday fear, but they also can't really touch or be in physical contact with their parents many times.
Yeah, I think both. Not being able to have typical or normal attachment, whether it's hugging a parent, cuddling with a parent, and also being faced with having to stay safe because their parents are frontline workers, increases anxiety.
Older kids can get online and understand the situation somewhat, but what about much younger kids?
Younger children are only going to know what parents are telling them. And so for them, it is going to be reiterating the story about germs and this is how we're keeping safe and simplifying it to their language. And it really is about still getting that comfort from another guardian that's home with them and who's going to be taking care of them and who's going to be the attachment figure currently in their life. That's really important for children to know too. And I would also say that it has to be paired with something that helps a child feel in control and connected to their parents. You're really trying to establish some predictability and routine, whether that means scheduled phone calls to keep in touch, letters, especially when it's feeling very uncertain and not knowing when this is going to end.
At what age do kids generally begin to understand the larger picture and self-soothe because of that?
Well, what we know developmentally is around the age of 8, metacognition kicks in and being able to engage in positive self-talk at that age, being able to label what they're feeling and putting things in place to help turn down that intensity, or it might be more behavioral. So things that they can do in the moment, but having a dialogue and an open dialogue at any age is incredibly important. But rooting them in what their parents are doing to keep safe as well, that way not only is the narrative about them at risk, but also about how they're keeping safe.
What about parents simply listening to their children without trying to convince them or reassure them of anything, just so their children feel heard?
Absolutely. Yes. Sitting with a child, hearing how they feel and just reflecting that back gives them the space to know that it's okay to feel what they're feeling. That in and of itself is grounding. It also is creating an attachment and a connection with an adult figure in their life. Validating that fear, saying, I hear you and you're right. The virus is real and I can potentially get sick at work. And you want to pair that with how at work, these are all the things that we do in order to keep clean, stay sanitized. We wear all these protective things in order to stay safe, and really honestly grounding them in what we know scientists and doctors are doing and what we know to do. And so while it feels like we can't control anything, we can.
We'll all do our best, right?
Yeah, we'll do our best and we'll get through it together.
Janine Dominguez is a clinical psychologist in the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Child Mind Institute in New York, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Hong Kong's government said Thursday that 12 opposition candidates in an upcoming election for seats in the city's legislature have been disqualified and that more could face a similar decision in the near term. Civic Party Chairman Alan Leong told reporters the government disqualified people it doesn't want to see in the next session of the Legislative Council. Qualified politician Dennis Kwok.
When the national security law was passed, I said that one country, two system is finished. Make no mistake about it. And I think today we are seeing the results of the relentless oppression that this regime is starting, not only just to take away the basic fundamental rights and freedom that was once enjoyed by all Hong Kong people under the Basic Law as promised under the Sino-British Joint Declaration. But they are also trying to drive fear and oppression into our hearts. And this, we must not let them succeed.
The government said advocating for self-determination, soliciting intervention of foreign governments, or expressing an objection in principle to the new national security law were behaviors that could not genuinely uphold the city's mini-constitution, the Basic Law. The government denied there was any political censorship or restriction of freedom of speech. But this week, Human Rights Watch wrote that, quote, Hong Kong authorities have rapidly begun to apply the new national security law to prosecute peaceful speech, curtail academic freedom, and generate a chilling effect on fundamental freedoms in the city. International Edition's Steve Miller asked their senior researcher, Maya Wang, to explain.
It's the fact that many kind of previously allowed activities and speech are now being unlawful. For example, organizing a democratic primary, which is essentially a poll, is now a violation of the national security law. And or the fact that saying liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our times, is also illegal, just saying so. Because people in Hong Kong never had to wonder what the red line was. There was no red line, unless, obviously, you break the law.
You bring up the political process. You know, we saw some pro-democracy and pro-self-determination individuals be elected to the Legislative Council a while back, and then they were disqualified because of the way that they interacted with the oath. And the NSL, you know, really makes it clear the way it's written is that if you do anything to perpetuate the notion that Hong Kong should be separate than China, that runs afoul with it. But you also mentioned that holding primaries could run afoul with it, and that was something that Carrie Lam did mention when the pro-democracy candidates were holding their polling not too long ago, but that did go through recently.
Yeah. Well, I think the way in which the Chinese government often deals with a sense of dissent in regions like Hong Kong, Tibet, and Xinjiang is to focus on the elements of pro-independence sentiments in the population, but at the same time using those sentiments as an excuse to crack down on freedoms and to repress the population. So what you do see is the fact that national security law and a lot of the legal enforcement, even prior to it, has led to the criminalization of a number of leaders in various political parties, from very establishment parties like the Democratic Party to, you know, like you said, the pro-independence groups like now Student Localism, are now facing charges for peaceful activities. So it is not just that this law is not just used against people or leaders of groups that promote independence, but really are used to repress kind of any push for democratic governance. However, I also think that the government has been concerned about international pushback, and that's why, you know, even though it intimidated the people and went to harass the people who organized this democratic primary, at the end it did allow it to go through.
I also want to ask you as to, you know, you touched on why the government may be expanding its powers there, taking a look at what's happening in mainland China, especially in Xinjiang with the Uyghur population. Has the international community not done enough to hold human rights up high enough for China not to enact policies on the mainland? And now that they're extending them to, you know, Hong Kong, which, you know, for, you know, all this time has operated under the one country, two systems policy.
Well, I think it's I almost want to laugh because, you know, of course, we have spent all those years telling many governments to take actions to the Chinese government's increasing aggression, cracking down on human rights domestically. And now these kind of violations are expanding essentially across the border, since, you know, Hong Kong is in some ways a city that belongs in, well, international, is an international city. But also you see kind of the chilling of freedom of expression by Chinese dissidents living abroad. So yes, no, the international community has not acted adequately for the last two decades or so over the Chinese government's behavior. And the increasing violations in Xinjiang and now in Hong Kong are symptoms of a Chinese government that just don't think they will be held accountable for any of the actions, whether it's about imprisoning or detaining a million Turkic Muslims unlawfully, or just kind of take away people's freedoms in Hong Kong overnight.
Maya Wang, senior China researcher for Human Rights Watch, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Herman Cain, a former Republican presidential candidate and supporter of President Donald Trump, who pointedly refused to wear a mask during the coronavirus pandemic, has died after contracting COVID-19. Cain learned of his diagnosis on June 29th. 9 days after attending a Trump rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he and many others crowded together without wearing face masks. Herman Cain was 74. The European Union imposed travel and financial sanctions Thursday on a department of Russia's military intelligence service and on firms from North Korea and China over their suspected participation in major cyber attacks across the world. Chinese government-linked hackers targeted biotech company Moderna, Inc., a leading U.S.-based coronavirus vaccine research developer earlier this year in a bid to steal valuable data. That, according to a U.S. security official tracking Chinese hacking activity, last week the U.S. Justice Department made public an indictment of two Chinese nationals accused of spying on the U.S., including three unnamed U.S.-based targets involved in medical research to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. NASA's next-generation Mars rover Perseverance blasted off from Florida's Cape Canaveral on Thursday atop an Atlas V rocket on a $2.4 billion mission to search for traces of potential past life on Earth's planetary neighbor, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine.
If this little rover were to discover biosignatures of ancient life on Mars, I think it would transform how we think about space exploration and discovery. I think you would see a lot of people wanting to do a lot more science and make discoveries as to what is out there, even in our own solar system.
The next generation robotic rover, a car-sized six-wheeled scientific vehicle, also is scheduled to deploy a mini helicopter on Mars and try out equipment to future human missions to the fourth planet from the sun.
NASA is one of those agencies. We do stunning things in good times and in bad times. We have a history of being able to do this. But look, there's a reason we call the robot Perseverance, because going to Mars is hard. It is always hard. It's never been easy.
Perseverance is expected to reach Mars next February.
America!
And with the excitement over the NASA launch, space exploration fan and jazz artist Gregory Porter, whose new single Concord is an ode to space exploration, performed Thursday as part of a ceremony marking the launch of NASA's next generation rover that will search for signs of habitable conditions on Mars. The Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter sang the Ray Charles version of America the Beautiful during the U.S. Space Agency's broadcast of the countdown to the launch at Cape Canaveral in Florida. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great weekend and be well.
Crossings. Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.